Alvin Queen is leading his band here with making some joyful noise with "There's Blues Everywhere." Ain't that the truth? Jesse Davis on alto sax, Terrell Stafford on trumpet and flugelhorn, Mike Ledon on Hammond B3, the organ, and Peter Bernstein on guitar. This is from Queen's 2006 album, I Ain't Looking at You. I love the title of the album, I Ain't Looking at You. That's great. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. And in the hinterlands here, we're getting ready for some treacherous thunderstorms and heavy rain. That is never a good thing. But, you know, you do something and some reason you're not thinking of everything, like, for example, why I chose to live here. And it was a lucky thing. It's on a, I said, elevated piece of ground. So even when there are major floods, we'll get flooding. Oh, yes, we will. But we will not get the kind of flooding that many people do get, because the sea and the rivers and everything, they kind of come together and create pools of water that would not go away for a long time after the main event. So we're watching to see how today's thunderstorms will go. It usually involves brownouts and blackouts. And most importantly, there are people in the low-lying areas closer to the water where the land is pretty flat and subject to inundation by water from the sea, water from the sewage systems. It's a mess. So we're hoping and praying that everything will go okay today. Well, I think we ought to talk about a very interesting development, and we're seeing politics unfolding before our very eyes. Political science, I should say. And that is the political science of the people. And the place I'm looking at is Puerto Rico, where people power is forcing out of office a governor, Ricardo Rosselló, and an administration that they can't stomach one day more. They've done all kinds of things to get the matter dealt with effectively. It hasn't worked. And the only solution that they could find, the last thing that they could try, is basically taking to the streets and letting it be known that this is not what they signed up for when they voted in Governor Ricardo Rosselló. Puerto Rico is devastated, not only by the natural issues that they've had to deal with the storm, Hurricane Maria, and other things, but just corruption at a scale we could hardly imagine. There's probably no spot in the current administration in Puerto Rico that is safe from corruption. And, you know, nobody wants to be in the streets. Nobody wants to risk violence. Nobody wants that, although many times you read the news, you would think that this is exactly what people have been waiting for, an opportunity to be violent in the streets. No. They've tried talking. They've tried negotiating. They've called for outside, meaning from Congress, monitoring. They've sought intervention. They've done everything you could think of. And yet, the money disappears that should have been allocated to things that help the people. And a layer of regulation is put in place to make sure that it is redirected to the quote right hands unquote. In Washington, there's no real hurry to safeguard the constitutional rights of the people of Puerto Rico. So when the people are looking for help, they're looking for a response that makes sense. There is no response. And the attitude is, look, you guys figure it out. We don't care. We may come to Puerto Rico for a nice little vacation, but that's as much as we really want to be dealing with Puerto Rico. So the people have taken the issue into their own hands. How do we solve this problem of being regulated by essentially a kind of governmental mafia? It's thuggery. The government is doing whatever it wants to do. And Washington is giving it license to do it. The government of Puerto Rico under Rosselló, had access to millions, in fact, billions of dollars that should have gone into development. It should have gone into paying off debts. It should have gone into building schools and hospitals. It should have gone into those things that any forward-thinking government would do to assure that the basics are taken care of. The people, the elderly, do not have to fear that they have a system that guarantees them that they can eat every day, have a meal every day. And this is especially important when you look at the history of Puerto Rico as a colonized state, still living in the manner of colonialism and imperialism. And it's a free for all. And it's weird, but when you look at the United States of America and you look at some of the major stories, under this particular president, it's like they've opened the barn door and everybody could do whatever they want. Pretty much assured that as long as they pledge their troth to the Republican Party and to Trump himself, they're okay, they're safe. And they put a hurting on people who have few alternatives, few ways of solving problems outside what they've been accustomed to doing. And we're talking about people living, for the most part, at a subsistence level. These are not wealthy people. Puerto Rico was a farming country for crying out loud. And in recent years, it added more to its portfolio. We see advances in research coming out of Puerto Rico. We see Puerto Rico developing its natural resources and moving ahead towards self-sufficiency, Of course, can't be total self-sufficiency when you've had a country that's been deep in colonial rule. Any country that has been under colonial rule will take some time to come into the fullness of its capacity for self-regulation and self-control. But the heartlessness of it, you saw when Trump went down to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria and told it, it was a show and tell kind of thing. Here's the President of the United States throwing rolls of paper towels at people in the audience. And, there was a lot of laughter about it, and it was incredibly insulting and heartless. They don't need paper towels, they need food. They need the trees cleared from the roads. They need the electrical system restored. These are the things that they need. And here comes a clown who is supposed to be lifting their spirits. This is his thinking. Well, let's play a game of toss the paper towels. And it was, to my mind, it should be a permanent marker for the people of Puerto Rico about how the United States government in Washington, D.C., and in the White House really thinks of what it really thinks of Puerto Rico. It still has that colonial mentality, only now it's much worse. It's about absolute greed. The land is being taken and divvied up in secret court hearings in Puerto Rico, in San Juan, and in New York City. And the only people in the room are the bankers, insurance agencies, governmental supposed oversight people, business people. It's business. Nobody there in the courtroom represents the interests of the people. So, with the only weapons they have to fight a mass battle, being themselves, Puerto Ricans have taken to the streets. And they're loud. And they cannot be avoided and ignored. And they are irritating this government that is doing everything to oppress them. But they scored a victory. Governor Rosello has decided that he would quit. He would quit. Well, how can't he not quit? He has nothing going for him right now, except perhaps fidelity by the military. But we will see today and tomorrow, and it's been growing and growing, but tomorrow is the big, big day. We will see what the resolve of people can do. They're not going to be the ones engaging in any kind of violence. The ones who will be talking about the utter and complete failure of government by conspiracy, how they have made people suffer for no reason other than they can do it and they could make money doing it. So people have been amassing, they have been speaking out loudly and clearly. And tomorrow, they will send that message definitively that this governor cannot be tolerated anymore. And he has to go. Now, that would naturally lead to what it naturally leads to. There's going to be a lot of infighting because other groups now who believe they have played especially important roles in achieving this will now vie for power. This is what typically happens. But the main thing I wanted to stress is these people advocating for basics. Children should have good schools, or should they should have schools, period. People should have decent jobs. The country should be safe and secure. The government should do exactly that. They've been given the charge to govern, not to plunder. And Puerto Rico should respect its past, the capacity that it never was supposed to have. It has it. It can run itself. It has the capacity to produce its own food. It has a capacity to build its own housing, but the money has been looted. And we even had the President of the United States when, in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, we saw the attitude of the United States that Puerto Rico was some kind of foreign country. That Puerto Rico had nothing to do with the United States. And then when it could ignore its duty no more, it gave a half-hearted response. But by then, thousands of people died needlessly. They still haven't figured out what the final number is. But we saw coming together all these various forces who recognize that it's back to basics. Puerto Rico has to have and affirm its identity and its rights. And you cannot leave it to the so-called leaders because they are enmeshed in several systems of corruption, some of them even overlapping each other. But tomorrow is going to be a great day in Puerto Rico, and a great day for those who watch what is happening in Puerto Rico. Something magical happens when people decide that politics is a hands-on proposition. It's not just for talking's sake. It's about doing. And in a sense, Puerto Rico is returning to its roots, its political roots of people-centered politics. It's a very, very, an unnecessarily hard road to that point. And yet it is the essence of politics. And creating changes, political, social, and economic. and securing in the hearts and minds of people, this is our country. And everybody deserves to thrive. Everybody deserves a fair shake. And especially vulnerable sectors of the population, you must make an effort to accommodate their needs. They can't help the situation they're in. They can't help that a storm decided to blast this country and tear it apart. And then the aftermath, people are talking about all the things that can't be done. When during colonial times, everything could be done. You can get a bunch of people and pay them next to nothing or nothing to erect these magnificent buildings and roads and whatnot to symbolize progress. But sometimes we have to look at the lessons being taught outside of the boundary lines about how people approach politics. In this sense, the approach was to hit the streets and be part of the physical manifestation of opposition to what is going on. So that if people had any idea or had any doubt or questions as to where people stand, there it is in front of your eyes. You don't have to guess anymore. You don't have to take surveys. You don't have to take polls. You're seeing for yourself what the people are feeling, what they want. But in the United States, we have, you know, an entirely different approach. Somebody else is supposed to do that. Somebody else is to take our place in the march. The government is supposed to fix it. But it's your community. Why is it that you don't put yourself high on the list of people who are supposed to fix things in your community? Many people are waiting in the United States, especially in extremely distressed communities. They're waiting for the government to come and fix the problem that the government has an interest in perpetuating. Poverty is one of the problems that the government has an interest in perpetuating. You cannot have a truly democratic society. It will not work, not according to the configurations that we are dealing with in the United States. The philosophy that backs it, the attitudes that entrench it. And we are sold a bill of goods about all the things that can't be done. It will take a long time, except when it is decided that it is the right time, it takes no time at all to get things done exactly the way they want them done. New York City, for example, always had housing. Not in good shape. Be clear. Much of it not in good shape. But why couldn't these communities have had a head start in creating housing that could serve the needs of the people? But when you have a real estate industry that shapes policy, they're not discussing, you know, the role of housing as part of an overarching plan, an integrated plan in creating a reasonably harmonious society. No, that's not. If that's what you're thinking, real estate, the real estate industry does, you're wrong. They're thinking about money, value. Even when they let certain parts, and they're usually the parts where people of color are, even when they let these parts deteriorate beyond reclamation, it has value. Because somebody's going to come along and they are going to buy the thing of real value. Value is not in providing housing. That's not value. Value is in building housing on reclaimed land that, by the mere fact of being redeveloped, shoots up in value. If people were to tell you now what's the newest trend in real estate, you would crack up. You'd say, that can't be true. You're lying to me. A new form of housing is developing. When these areas are reclaimed, they're building what they call tiny houses. Where? On the roofs, where nobody needs to see them. Tiny little houses will be built and constructed on the roofs of these buildings, where they are out of sight. And people will pay a serious markup for a little hovel on the top of a building in a particular area. And they'll still market this as special because they have, by then, excuse me, they would have cleansed the community, physically cleansed it of all the undesirable elements, meaning the people living there. If you watch or you monitor the incredible pace of sales in Harlem, East Harlem, the parts that were thrown away and have been thrown away for decades now, people are paying, on average, in reconstituted buildings, apartments, studios, 1 and 2 bedroom apartments, as much as 2,000 and more per month. It has nothing to do essentially with the intrinsic value of the building. It has to do with the function of the plan. You empty a space. You put nothing on it for a long, long time, because while it's sitting there, it's still accruing in value. And then at a right time, when you sense that the time is right, You pick a perimeter within this abandoned space and you start there. And everything is totally inflationary. Everything is totally unrealistic, but it's selling. I just saw that a group of people in Manhattan living in, they had organized a co-op some time ago. And they were willing to pay a developer $25 million not to build and block their view. This is madness. But it is the new reality. And that new reality accompanies a wave of changes that will determine who deserves privileges and who deserves no privileges. It will realign the idea of rich and poor because the people who used to be rich are now poor. So a new configuration has to take place. So you have people saying, look, I want my view. We will put together $25 million and pay you to not put up a building that would block our view of the skyline. I mean, this is ridiculous. But all of this stuff is happening in communities that had been or have been written off. The fight really is among people who realize now they've got to make a stand. There's no, you're not going to win being passive. You have to be involved. You have to be involved to make changes. You have to build a power base that people will respect, meaning you have the ability in building this power base to affect things, to affect decisions. But we are lazy. Politically, we are lazy. And we have no interest in actually participating in anything. We want to stay on the sidelines and see how it all turns out, which is what the people who have in mind to do things, they know this very well about us. We really don't like being directly involved in anything because it means we'll have to work at it. We'll have to invest a portion of ourselves in it. It's not directly affecting me, so why am I to be bothered? We still have that. And so we watch things develop. And then we get slammed by them, but because we have this racist society, some people can actually afford to do nothing because they will be beneficiaries of massive change anyway. So when we look at Puerto Rico, and this is what we should use as an example. It's the most recent example. We've had many people-centered movements, people-powered movements, where people have reached the point of no return. They have to do something. Why? Their survival is on the line. Their survival is in peril. And that is perhaps the greatest motivating force for action. Your survival is at stake, and there's no question about it. You have to do something, or they will. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about that. What do we see, and what do we gain in observing this unfolding issue in Puerto Rico? It's important for us to look at these things in an analytical way. And you'll see how we return to the same theme time and time again about survival. When people reach the point of understanding clearly that their choices are very, very slim, but the main duty that they have to themselves and to their communities is survival. You can't achieve it by yourself. This kind of survival requires an understanding that people have to come together. And they have to understand how much they have in common and that their interests are in protecting their common survival, their common, the common thrust of maintaining their families and their communities and themselves. That's what's important. Now, my good friend Elisa, who lives in Puerto Rico, and she's filed so many reports with us, well, we couldn't hear from her today, and we probably may not be able to connect with her tomorrow, owing to the massiveness of this, and of course, we don't have the same equipment as a CNN or an MSNBC, but she has given us so far enough information to help us understand that there is a massive conspiracy of corruption that has had a stranglehold on Puerto Rico for way too long. And that the clamor by the people to have it fixed hasn't been heard. They've elected new governments, and the successive governments are also corrupt. So where do they go? They have no choice now because they understand their survival, their very survival is at stake. And they now have to fight to protect it. Why are we waiting until it reaches that point where you suffer in the meantime and you'll suffer when it is achieved? Are we just armchairing? We just sit and observe the fray rather than, in what ways are we involved in building our communities, restoring and reclaiming our communities? In the end, it comes down to that. There is no greater defense. There's no greater assurance of, I would say, your safety, your economic, social, political safety than in building strong communities. So we'll hear about your views right after this at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We're talking about, we're seeing living examples of how things result in consequences. It's not easy to undo the consequences, but you have to do it at some point, because the ultimate goal here is survival. We'll be right back after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking about what's about to happen in Puerto Rico. And it is an education, it is a lesson, and it is something that we should all take to heart, because in one way or the other, this is where we all have to go. We all have to formulate solutions to our problems, because our problems are systemic, and if we are to progress at all, we have to have something that we control. The power should rest in our hands. And so the people of Puerto Rico, who have been staging massive demonstrations for a while now, have had it with this corrupt government. And it's not the first corrupt government in Puerto Rico, but they are beginning to understand the link between, not they are not beginning to understand, they've understood this a long time. Puerto Rico has been a target for a very long time, from Washington, D.C. and the White House. And they're getting together again tomorrow to make one final blow, which would inevitably mean that the governor must go. And that's their start. The government will have to go and something else put in place. But they have decided they're not going to wait and see how it will be fixed. They're doing it themselves. 888-874-4888. Maat, you're starting us off today.
Yes. thanks. Greetings to the beloved PRN family.
Thank you, Maat.
Point of clarification, the last I had heard was that Rosello was not going to run for a next term. But has he actually stepped down from his governorship?
Not yet.
Okay. Well,
but it is imminent.
I would hope so. One thing that's encouraging is you see that the people's last resort is to get out into the streets and make their wishes known, and they've done it very, very creatively, with performance art, poetry, very striking banners and posters, et cetera, et cetera. I'm also wondering, when is there going to be some fiscal accountability? Because they know that there's been looting of the funds, but it's sort of in a vague type stance, and whether they can look at it forensically without the federal government coming in. That's to me is a big concern, because of course Trump has jumped on the bandwagon and he's singling out the mayor, Cruz, I think her last name is, even
yes,
though she's one of the people that was attacked because she was trying to do the right thing. The other point I want to make is that when you have a so-called leader of the land who uses fifth grade schoolboy type taunts and criticisms and nonsensical outrages, this is like a contagion. So if you've looted the people of what is rightfully theirs, the last thing you would think that you would do would be to get on some social media or text or whatever the case and just act like idiots. It to me is also a parallel that's going on with the border people, including the acting director, just participating in all kinds of cruelty and abusive taunts and outrages. One thing that Trump and his administration doesn't seem that they're going to deal with is what was done to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in that they put on a social media site her being sexually assaulted by the president. I mean, how does that get past the smell test?
Well, it gets past to the extent that people allow it to pass. You will know, I mean, there could be the greatest animus between the White House and certain groups across the country, but Trump will be extremely careful not to cross the line. Nobody has to ask him to not cross the line. Nobody has to beg for respect. It is automatic, and it is because these groups have power. It is because these groups have demonstrated what the cost will be to violating any member of their group or the group as a whole. But when anything goes and really awful things are said and done by the president and the administration, and people, you know, they do the predictable thing. People complain, or they bring to the attention, look how we're being treated poorly. At a certain point, it comes down to this. How much power does your group have? And in what ways can you influence outcomes of things? If you can't influence the outcome of things, then you're wide open. If people understand that, look, when you mess with this group over here, they are known to be fiercely defensive of their group or of their culture or of their religion.
Protective,
or of
yes.
The history.
Mm-hmm.
So people would tend to leave these groups alone. They will not be the butt of racist jokes. They will not be made fun of and people laughing at them. They will not be lifted up as stereotypes, undesirable stereotypes. But you see, we haven't sent these kinds of messages. Our communities remain wide open to anybody wanting to make fun. There's nothing sacred. We haven't held anything really in particular sacred to us that we're willing to die for. We don't have that kind of tenacity. Many groups have it. And you don't even have to contemplate. Nobody thinks of doing the wrong thing to these groups.
Good point. And you're now, sure you... people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, I'm not suggesting that they should be attacked in any way, but you notice that the only four women of color that are being tagged as hating the country and socialists and, you know, he always projects. He said that he just makes up stuff that Ocasio said that the country was garbage. He never said that, but he said that when Obama was president, you know, so his projection is targeting only certain people because the so-called white people who he could say, I mean, the socialists is ridiculous, you know, and they're being far left as opposed to the danger of their far-right Republican Party now. So we're just living in the middle of craziness. That's all.
You're right. We are living in the middle of craziness because something is happening, and that is the society itself as a whole is changing. And the ways of doing things also are changing. So we operate with a view, and it's a bit unrealistic, that people have formed ideas by now. They haven't. Not for the most part, they haven't. They're in the process, but they haven't reached hard and fast conclusions about things. Many groups have. Many groups have not. Why? The groups that have are groups that have been targeted. They've been on the other end of the spear. The groups that are still changing are groups that enjoyed certain privileges, and they're now dealing with the fact that their estimation of how society behaves has been wrong. And they got to change up. But don't forget, and we have to take this into consideration, for many, it is a courageous act to get out of the ghetto that they've been in. The political, social, and economic ghetto. Believing themselves to be people of privilege, for example. That has hit many whites in this country very hard. And now they have to make adjustments. They have to relearn what this is all about and accept facts that they previously had either ignored or rejected. The fact that we are all one, because this is a democracy, for example, it's the biggest piece of propaganda there has been, but it worked so well, and it became the mantra of people who had enough sense to know that it wasn't true, but it granted them certain privileges, social privileges, economic privileges, and so they adhered to dogmas that were not true at all. Many people are facing this dilemma. How could they have not seen the truth of these things? So, thank you for getting us started, Maat. Tom from Connecticut, you're next.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
I don't recall the gentleman's name, a professor who you've had on quite a few times, talking about popular revolutions in many different countries.
Gerald Horn.
Yes. And I believe I got through on a call one time and posed the question to him, at what point did any movement really fulfill what the goal was to galvanize the people and then move them into a point of power where it wasn't then corrupted by greed and avarice and everything else that corrupts human beings? And he really paused and he kind of said, well, yeah, you have a point. I'm just wondering, in this country, what would be the impetus that would allow, first of all, a change like this to happen? And then, really, would the outcome be just the same with different faces, catering to different groups that are in their favor.
Well, we look at history, and history gives us the answer. When people come together with a shared vision, a shared quest, a shared idea about what it is they want to do, they proceed to do it. Now, this has nothing to do with whether it's right or wrong.
No, absolutely.
Okay.
But there's,
so we had the great founding fathers and all of that. When you look closely, you see how wrong they were. You see how psychotic they were in their thinking. That you could leave one country, you come to another country, you employ mass annihilations, genocides, because your intention is to, well, these people obviously will become your enemies, if not now, very soon, so you obliterate them, and you take over the country. Now, that sounded like a very logical plan to them. And they did it. They constructed, methodically, all the pieces of apparatus, of the apparatus of control, mass control. And they implemented it. They call it, struggle for independence.
Well, that's, yes.
Yeah. Struggle for independence. But when you look at it, you see it really was about mass slaughter and taking over. Uh-oh, music means I gotta go. Well,
take
I
care.
Do have to go, and we'll talk about, we'll follow this up tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening today. Bye-bye.